Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, October 8th, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is busy getting ready for the cyclocross race and lots of other things. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at FranStorchND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult your physician. I'm still post-surgical. I'm just over 2 weeks after my surgery, and I'm feeling better than I was last time I made a show, so that's exciting. And I'm starting to discover that I think it's time for me to move more, that when I lay around too much, I don't feel well, and that if I move enough, but not too much, I feel better. So I went for a walk with Ron. We went for a walk around the Mansfield Hollow cyclocross course, and that was nice. If I have a moderate amount of being up and about, I seem to do better than if I do too much lying around. On this past Thursday was Yom Kippur. I did Zoom at home because I didn't think it would be good for me to go in. And I really didn't feel well on Thursday. I almost felt like I was getting sick, but I wasn't getting sick. I thought, oh my goodness, I have a fever. I have inflammation. Maybe I have an infection. And I didn't have any of that. I think when you're healing from surgery, you have some days where you feel inflamed. Your body is going after the site to help to rebuild what's going on there. And you actually can feel like you're sick. But I wasn't sick. I kept taking my temperature. It was fine. And I'm thinking, I'm not going to get a temperature probably because I'm taking a bunch of acetaminophen. So I'm still taking acetaminophen. And depending on the day, I'm taking more or less. Today, I have taken 1,000 milligrams so far. And you know, the limit is 4,000 milligrams in a day. And I usually don't approach that. So I'm taking anywhere from 1,000 to 2,100 milligrams a day, and that's it. And most days it's not that. Most days I'm doing less now. I have to be careful because on the one hand, if I'm feeling pretty good, then I feel like, oh, I don't need to take it. And then I get caught because I'm not covering my pain. And it's one of this balancing act when you're post-surgical. You want to feel like you're better now and you want to not have to take your medicine. But on the other hand, if you have things that you're going to do and you need coverage for pain, you kind of have to cover the pain. I haven't done any opioids at all. I don't want to do opioids. And, you know, Ron says the opioids don't really help. And so I was taking tizanidine occasionally, which is a pretty powerful muscle relaxant. And then I had an appointment with the APRN, with Tamika, on this past Wednesday. And we talked about my progress. She thought my progress is just fine. I still have numbness and discomfort and pressure in my left leg. But she said that's going to take months to go away. The really acute pain, what she would expect to go away, but I wasn't in a really acute state. I have ongoing nerve pain and that's still there. It's a combination of the nerve is damaged and needs to heal. And the other side of it is that I still have inflammation at the surgical site. So there's still pressure on those nerve roots. And so when that clears up, I may have a reduction in that discomfort. But, you know, I had Tamika give me the printout of what they did in the surgery, and they took out some calcifications. They took out part of my ligamentum flavum, which is a ligament that helps to hold up your spinal column, and because it was sitting on my spinal cord. So they took part of that out at the L2 to L4 levels, and I think they might have cleaned up some cartilage or disc stuff, and so then they do this thing where they put a hook through. And they do a foraminotomy. So the foramina are the holes where the nerve roots come out. And so what they do is they go in and they make sure that there's a clear path for the foramen, that there's nothing pushing on your nerve roots as they come out. Those are the holes in your vertebrae where the nerves come out. So they put a hook through to make sure it goes through. And so they did that at both the L2, L3 and the L3, L4 levels. And they said the hook passed through easily. Like I said, Dr. Lantner said that the surgery went fine. There was nothing unexpected. It was very routine and very normal. And when I saw Tamika, she said, you're healing fine. And she said that I had Steri-Strips on my back. And she looked at the stent. When she looked at my back, she said, your incision is healed. I'll take those Steri-Strips off for you. And you may immerse yourself. So she said, you could go swimming. You could go to the therapy pool. You could take a bath. I probably can go and do a float. So I might do that. I'm not going to do the float right away, maybe in a couple of weeks. But I might go take an Epsom salt bath once it gets cooler out. I haven't been feeling like taking a bath when it's still warm out because I get too warm. But Epsom salt baths are very soothing as long as it's not too warm out. And today, the weather has been going up and down. We've been having 60 degree days and 80 degree days. And today we approached 80. So even though it's autumn, and so I won't be getting in the bath today. But I do have topical magnesium. I have lotion with Epsom salts in it. I have oil with magnesium in it. I have topicals that have menthol and camphor and other herbs in it, so I'm still using those. I have one menthol camphor topical that has CBD in it, so I'm using that, and that's nice too. And I have some CBD that I've been taking as well for inflammation. And then in terms of the muscle relaxants, like I said, I had talked to Tamika about the fact that I was taking tizanidine. She said she was surprised that I had asked for it, and she says that older people, she said, you're too young, but older people, they often tell you, you don't give them methocarbamol for some reason. And so they're supposed to have tizanidine, but people complain that tizanidine makes them lightheaded. And I read that methocarbamol tends to be gentler than tizanidine. So I said, please, Tamika, prescribe me some methocarbamol. So she did. So I took half a methocarbamol the other day, and then the next day I didn't feel good. I had digestive upset. I don't know if it was from the methocarbamol or something else. So I haven't taken it since. So I will probably try again at another time. I'm not sure when I want to do it because, you know, if I have stuff to do tomorrow, I don't want to be queasy. But I want to see if the thing works and if it gives me digestive upset. The tizanidine did not, but it made me a little bit dizzy. But the methocarbamol did not. It just, the next day I had some stomach upset. I have no stomach upset now, which is great. What I do notice is if I lie down, if I sit up too long, like sit up in an upright position in a chair, like right now I'm sort of reclining in a chair while I'm talking to you. And if I lie down on my back for too long, I get up and I don't feel good. I can sleep. If I sleep on my side, you know, when I go to bed at night, I go to sleep on my side and that's okay. So I think what goes on is when I recline for too long, or I sit up, when I sit up for too long, there's too much pressure on the spinal column, and that obviously makes it hurt more. And when I lie on my back for too long, I think what we have is there's still inflammation in the spinal area, in the area of the incision, and so inflammation happens, and there's pooling that happens. And when I move around, that it gets that to move around. So I think that I'm ready to do some more movement. I talked to Tamika and said, can you give me some exercises to do? She said, I'll write you for PT. I said, okay. So she's not into giving the exercises out. She'd rather send me for PT, which is cool. So we put in an order to Select, and I'm going to go see Will at Select on Wednesday, which I'm looking forward to. And I will present him with the list of exercises I had with Mary, and, you know, we'll add and subtract, and maybe he'll have other ones, and we'll see what he says that I can do. I am feeling more and more like I can bend and twist a little bit, but I'm afraid to do that yet because I'm maybe not supposed to. Even just because you can doesn't mean you should. Thank you, Angie. After laminectomy surgery, you know, there's you're limited in how you can move, but I'm naturally flexible and I can bend over and pick stuff up. I don't need a grabber or anything, but maybe I shouldn't be doing that. I don't know. But certainly a pose where, like caterpillar pose in yoga, where you are sitting on the ground with your legs in front of you and your spine folded over, I probably shouldn't be doing that right now. And I'm probably shouldn't be doing spinal twists either, but I will talk to Will on Wednesday. So that's why I haven't done restorative yoga, although I might do it tomorrow night and just leave out anything that doesn't feel right. If there's any forward bends, I won't do that. If there's any twisting, I won't do that. If there's spinal twist, I'll just lie on one side in the fetal position and just listen to Angie talking to me to relax. So I might do that tomorrow night. We'll see if I'm around. And walking, as long as it's not too long or far, or if the terrain's too intense, and if I can walk on pretty much flat ground, I'm okay. So I think I'm going to start going for walks, like actual walks. Also, I have to say, Tamika said on Wednesday that I could get on the trainer, on the bike, on the trainer. She said, don't ride outside yet, but do get on the trainer if you want to. So she didn't know what Zwift was, so I'd explained to her what Zwift was. I haven't done that yet. I'm nervous to do that. I'm thinking I'm going to wait until Wednesday when I talk to PT. The other thing I'm going to do is on Monday, I'm going to go have chiropractic. And Dr. Scott said, as long as you can lie down on the table and I can work on you, you can come. And I will work way around your incision. I work way around the spot where you had surgery and stay away from it. Because other things need to be balanced. My knees need to be balanced, my hips, my upper back, my neck. So I'll see him. I was going to see acupuncture a week from today, but I'm not going to do that just because I have something going on. So I pushed that out a little bit. And if I feel like I have time, I'm going to go to acupuncture. Acupuncture is no reason why I shouldn't have acupuncture. Again, I talked to Nicole and Nicole's like, well, in China, they use acupuncture for anesthesia. And so there's no reason why you shouldn't have acupuncture now. And Tamika admonished, don't let her put needles in around right near the incision site. And I said, sure, I will tell her that she should stay away from directly from the incision site. I'm sure Nicole knows to do that. So anyway, so I might go for acupuncture as well. And so things are moving along. Of course, I would like to be able to do more. I'd like to be able to sit in my office chair without being sore. But sitting up in my office chair has never been a great thing for me. And that's probably part of how I got disc degeneration anyway. Sitting in a chair at your computer is not a great thing. And here I am doing that right now talking to you. I mean, I am kind of leaning back. I have my feet propped up and it's okay. So anyway, that's what's going on. I'm back to taking all my supplements. I haven't had a blood clot. I really haven't had any complications. The incision is starting to itch, which is a good thing. That means circulation is getting back to the area. It doesn't itch all the time. Sometimes I scratch around it a little bit. Probably what I should do is throw some calendula cream on the area. She said also it can get wet. You can wash it in the shower if you want to. So I'm gentle. I don't like scrub the area hard or anything, but the shower puff goes over it with the soap and that's fine too. So that's what's going on. I could be so much. I remember how bad Ron was 2 weeks after his surgery. It was very different. That, of course, the surgery that I had was minimally invasive. So, we would expect that I'd be in better shape. And I remember the first day I made a show after the surgery, it was less than a week after the surgery, and I really didn't feel good sitting there like that. Right today, I would say I feel a lot better sitting here talking to you. So anyway, so that's what's going on with me. Ron is better and better. He gets sore. His neck gets sore at the end of the day, and he has to ice it, and he has to stretch, and he still feels like he's got post-surgical discomfort, and he hasn't felt ready to do very much riding outdoors. He is riding indoors, teaching his classes and doing stuff like that. So that's what's going on with us. All right, so let's talk about some timely issues. One of the things that's been going on in the world is talk about Tylenol and autism. So world health officials have countered the president's unproven claim of the link between acetaminophen and autism. So that's interesting. So health officials all over the world rejected President Trump's warning that pregnant women should limit the use of acetaminophen over unsubstantiated claims of a link to autism. From Australia to Europe, the experts moved swiftly to respond to the U.S. announcement, which he made with great fanfare with Secretary of Health Robert Kennedy Jr. Don't take Tylenol, don't take it, and fight like heck not to take it, he said. He used a different word. But a range of experts worldwide noted there's not conclusive evidence to support the possible association between autism and acetaminophen, which is the active ingredient in Tylenol and other widely used medications, and no new evidence to warrant a change in guidance. The available evidence has found no link between the use of paracetamol, which is the European word for acetaminophen, during pregnancy and autism. The European Medicines Agency said that. And as I said, paracetamol is what they call acetaminophen outside of the U.S. It's the same thing. So the European Medicines Agency wouldn't be making changes to the region's current recommendations, maintained that pregnant women should take the lowest effective dose of the drug for the shortest possible time and as infrequently as possible, which is a good idea. A lot of data from pregnant women who used paracetamol during pregnancy indicates no risk of malformations in the developing fetus or newborns, and the World Health Organization said the evidence remains inconsistent regarding the link between Tylenol to pregnancy and autism. So the World Health Organization spokesperson cited unspecific studies that pointed to a possible link, but said that that wasn't confirmed by subsequent research. The lack of replicability calls for caution in drawing conclusions. So the president on Monday also suggested that additives in vaccines may cause autism, which the World Health Organization was similarly quick to dispute. We know that vaccines don't cause autism. As said, they save countless lives, so this is something that science has proven, and the thing should not be questioned. Australian health officials were among the first to reject the claims, labeling them a misrepresentation of the science. And Australia's medicines regulator, which is called the Therapeutic Goods Administration, with the country's chief medical officer, said that it was joining other global medicine regulators in repudiating Trump's claims. There's good scientific evidence that shows no causal link between paracetamol and pregnancy and autism or ADHD, with a lot of large, reliable studies contradicting these claims. A number of other countries restated the existing guidance, which differs from the new warning by the Trump administration. And New Zealand's Ministry of Health reiterated that its guidance hasn't changed, describing paracetamol as the safest medicine to take in pregnancy for the treatment of pain and fever, and that's probably true. A spokesperson for the German health ministry told NBC News that there was no link between paracetamol during pregnancy and developmental abnormalities. In certain situations, taking medication is necessary to avoid endangering the mother and unborn child, like in the case of high fever. And the UK's health regulator, MHRA, also issued a similar statement stressing paracetamol remains the recommended pain relief for pregnant women and when used as directed. When you don't treat pain and fever, it can pose risks to the unborn baby. So it's important to manage those symptoms with the recommended treatment, said Dr. Allison Cave, who was chief safety officer at the MHRA. So the health secretary, Wes Streeting, told ITV in Britain, "I would just say to people watching, don't pay attention to what Donald Trump says about the medicine." And Spain's health minister, Monica Garcia Gomez, also called out Trump by name, accusing him of ignoring medical studies. And denialism not only destroys trust in science, it puts lives at risk. And then Scott White, chair of the Royal Australian New Zealand College of OBGYNs, said he was worried about the messaging from the U.S. that paracetamol is safe and actually important to use because pain and fever are associated with adverse neurodevelopmental outcomes themselves. Really worried about the messaging that says pregnant women should just tough it out, that they should be denied access to pain relief, which is a fundamental human right, and it's every woman's right. To suggest that women can't access a medication that we feel has been to be safe simply because they're pregnant is misogynistic. Wow. White cited a study published last year in the Journal of American Medical Association, studied 2.5 million children in Sweden, comparing siblings, and found no association between acetaminophen during pregnancy and the risk of autism, ADHD, or intellectual disability. Other studies have suggested some kind of link, including research published last month that the Trump administration officials are citing. There's argument that many struggle to exclude factors like genetics or environment. Outside autism, researchers have said that literature reviews by researchers from Harvard and the Kahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai wasn't rigorously conducted, and the cherry-picked studies that supported the conclusion. White also said that the reason a woman is taking paracetamol or acetaminophen, such as to treat a fever or infection, could be what affects the mental development of the child. That's interesting, too. We know that a woman who's got complicated pregnancies in some way are more likely to go on to have babies that are neurodevelopmentally impacted. So the general feeling among world scientists is based on the research that acetaminophen, if you don't use it excessively, can be safe and effective for pain relief and fever during pregnancy. There is a concern that if a fever gets too high during pregnancy, that it's going to cause neurodevelopmental issues like possibilities of ADHD or autism and possibility of neurodevelopmental delay. and also other developmental defects. So the research apparently does not bear this out. It is probably true that if you overdo anything, if you do or overdo any kind of pharmaceutical medication, it's not a good idea. So if a woman is, the problem is that when you're in pain, pain causes stress. I can tell you that right now, that your cortisol will go up, your blood pressure goes up. When you are in a lot of pain, one of the reasons you manage the pain is because the actual pain causes a stress response in your body that is not necessarily good for you. So alleviating pain can be helpful in that it calms down that stress response. If you have a woman who is overly stressed while she's pregnant, the stress hormones themselves can suppress reproductive hormones and suppress other processes and cause degeneration of certain body parts. Like when you have too much cortisol around, cortisol, what does cortisol do? It runs around your body looking for stuff to break down, turn it into sugar so you can run away from the bear. And if you have excessive cortisol while you're pregnant, the whole thing about pregnancy is a proliferative event. It is an event where you are growing. You are growing a baby. You are growing yourself. You're growing your fatty tissue. You're growing blood vessels. You're growing a uterus. You're growing a placenta. So all of these things are growing, and you need the hormones to function that way in that proliferative manner. In order to grow, you need to have calm. And when you are in rest and digest, you're more likely to grow. In fact, most of growth happens when you're sleeping. So you do the things to help you grow, like exercise and move your muscles and move your body and eat food while you're awake. But most of the gains happen while you're sleeping. So the more calm you are, the more growth can happen. And that goes for growing a baby and growing all the structures in and around that baby in your body so that the pregnancy can happen. So if you have high cortisol, cortisol breaks down tissue, and you don't want to have high cortisol. And if you are in a lot of pain, you're going to be more likely to have high cortisol. So reducing pain is a good idea. Fever also, if you have an excessively high fevers, those are in concert with inflammatory events. If the fever is too high, that you want to have an optimal temperature situation in a woman's body while she is gestating. And so if the fever is too high, that can be a problem too. Now, there are things you can do that are not acetaminophen to help with these things, but sometimes they don't work. And, you know, for me, you know, I would rather not take any pharmaceutical meds at all right now for my pain. But in order to function, I'm kind of, like I said, I'm playing this weighing game about whether I should take the medicine or not. Because if I let the pain go too far, then I can't function, and then I have stress, and then I don't feel well, and I have a sensitive autonomic nervous system. So that's not as critical for me as it is for a woman who is pregnant. It is critical for me if I'm sitting with a patient, because if I have autonomic dysfunction while I'm with a patient, I could get lightheaded, dizzy, and pass out, and I could have a rise in blood pressure and all kinds of things like that. So managing pain isn't just about the pain itself. It's about managing the stress response to the pain. And when a woman is pregnant, the more stressed she is, that cortisol is suppressive to reproductive hormones that are helping to maintain the pregnancy. And it is also, it's deproliferative. It's catabolic. And you don't want to have an excess of a catabolic hormone on board when you're trying to grow a baby, a body, a uterus, a placenta, blood vessels, all the things that you're trying to grow when you have a pregnancy. So if you have tried all the other things, and then there's a lot of supplements that you can't take. You can take magnesium when you're pregnant. You can take fish oil when you're pregnant, and those can be helpful for pain. But they're not direct pain relievers. You can't take curcumin when you're pregnant. You can't take boswellia, frankincense, when you're pregnant. Because there's a lot of herbs that it's not clear if they're safe in pregnancy, and there are other herbs that we're clear we don't take in pregnancy. You don't take aspirin. You don't take ibuprofen in pregnancy. So that means you can't take white willow. White willow has any of the herbs with salicylates. White willow, filipendula, meadowsweet, and other herbs, spirea, all the herbs that have salicylates in them, you don't take those when you're pregnant. And so So you're left with either you can take some, and you certainly can't take opioids. So you're left with either you're going to take acetaminophen, or you're going to do physical things to help with your pain. You can take fish oil, you can take magnesium, you can take homeopathy, and you can get the right homeopathic remedy for whatever kind of pain that you're having. You can take cell salts, which are kind of like homeopathy also. And there's just 12 cell salts, and they're all mineral salts. That's all they are. And they're in low-dose homeopathic potencies. So those are safe to take as well. And, you know, you can certainly do things like hydrotherapy. You can do heat and cold to various parts of your body. You can take baths. So any kind of hydrotherapy you can do. You can do acupuncture when you're pregnant. Of course, there are forbidden points during pregnancy, and your acupuncturist is generally going to know what those are. I mean, if you're going to go have acupuncture, just make sure your acupuncturist knows the forbidden points of pregnancy, and they teach them that. Because I remember when I was in Oregon, and you know, we would share some classes with the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine. They would come over and take some of the basic physical medicine knowledge classes, and like they would take biology or biochemistry and physics and anatomy and physiology at our naturopathic college. I don't know if they still do that, but you know, everything was smaller back then, so there was some overlap between the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine, the National College of Naturopathic Medicine, and Western States Chiropractic College. We would see each other, so they teach them, and as I recall, when I was when my roommate was an acupuncturist, it was at going to OCOM at the time, and I remember they teach, well, two of my roommates, that they teach them the forbidden points of pregnancy, and so your acupuncturist is going to know that, that's a way that you can manage pain as well. You could also get cranial sacral therapy, and you can get massage, and you can get chiropractic. But if those don't all work for you and you've tried a lot of conservative means, you're limited as to what you can take. And if you absolutely have to, taking a bit of acetaminophen is probably going to be okay. But if you cannot take it, it's better. Why? Because when you take acetaminophen, you have to remember that every time you take acetaminophen, you're accessing your liver. Your liver uses glutathione to detoxify the metabolites of acetaminophen. So you're depleting your, I'm concerned with myself that I'm taking acetaminophen every day. I'm getting rid of a lot of overusing my glutathione to help metabolize this drug. So once I'm done with the acetaminophen, I will probably either take glutathione or I will take NAC. I'm taking vitamin C already, but I'll take NAC. NAC and acetylcysteine plus vitamin C will help you to produce glutathione and selenium as well. Or I could just take some glutathione too. But I think you get more increase in glutathione by taking vitamin C, selenium, and NAC. So I will probably do that. But right now I'm concerned about taking it, because if I take too much NAC, then I'm going to have more glutathione around, and that's going to reduce the effectiveness of the acetaminophen, right? I'm not taking milk thistle either, because again, I want my liver to be working a little less well, so I keep the drug on board. And this is something I have to talk to my patients about as well, that if they're taking pharmaceutical medicines, and they're concerned about, they want to do some liver detox, they can't necessarily take certain things that increase liver detoxification, because it will effectively reduce the doses of the drugs they're taking. So it kind of depends on what they're taking and what the mechanisms of action of the drugs are. So you have to hook them up to that. So for example, my lisinopril I'm taking for my blood pressure, that's a very interesting drug. And you can take liver tonics with lisinopril, because lisinopril is not metabolized. It's not metabolized by the liver or the kidneys or anything. It goes in, it exerts its effect, and you pee it out unchanged. So it's a very interesting drug. If you want to do liver detox and you can tolerate the lisinopril and you don't cough too much, it's a good drug to use. On the other hand, you know, I can only take 5 milligrams of it, and I may, once I'm done with this, healing from the surgery, I may talk to Dr. LaGuardia about switching to a different drug, like an ARB, an angiotensin receptor antagonist. The only problem with ARBs is that they are detoxified through the liver, and I may not be able to take my liver tonics. So the best thing I could do is no sugar, no caffeine, no alcohol, and lose a bunch of weight, and then I would be able to, then I might be able to get away with just 5 milligrams of lisinopril. So anyway, as far as I'm concerned, if you have to take acetaminophen when you're pregnant, you could probably take it. If you're not taking it every single day, if you're taking it once in a while, it's probably all right. The more you do it, the more there is cause for concern. And somebody made a good point in this article that the event that caused you to need to take the acetaminophen is something that could bring on some defects or problems with the developing fetus. If you have a severe illness or a severe inflammatory event, that in and of itself can cause problematic things in terms of growth and development of a fetus. So when you could be attributing the changes in development, in neurodevelopment, or in terms of autism and ADHD, you may be attributing it to the acetaminophen when really you should be attributing it to the inflammatory event that happened. And if that's true, then it's a good idea to take the acetaminophen because it's going to calm down. It's not technically anti-inflammatory. Acetaminophen is a very interesting drug, and I've talked about this before. They say it's not anti-inflammatory, that it's analgesic, and yet when you look at the mechanisms of action of acetaminophen, it actually does have a little bit of effect on COX and LOX. COX is cyclooxygenase and LOX is lipoxygenase, and those are inflammatory pathways in the body, and it does affect those to some extent. That's part of how it exerts its pain relief. So really, it does have some anti-inflammatory effects. It's not as intense as ibuprofen or aspirin or naproxen. The other thing it does is it accesses the endocannabinoid system, and I did not know that, and that's very cool. I think it bonds to anandamide receptors as well, and so it has a number of activities that are kind of cool, and so I'm happy to take it. I am not somebody who likes to take pain medication. I'm really trying to take as little as possible, and I'm taking it not because I'm like, oh, I have to get away from the pain. It's more that I have to function, and I'm trying to be careful to not get myself in pain. So if you are pregnant, the best thing for you to do is not necessarily listen to me. As I've always said, you should not construe what I'm saying as medical advice or direction. You should be talking to your doctor. So whoever your obstetric provider is, that's who you should be talking to, whether it's your certified professional midwife, or it's your CN certified nurse midwife, or your APRN, or your obstetrician. Whoever it is, that's who you should be talking to about whether you should be taking acetaminophen. And you can also just contact them in every case. In other words, if you are having pain or a fever right now, get a hold of your provider and say, should I take the acetaminophen now and how much? And they'll talk to you about dosing and whether you should take it or not. And they'll give you good advice about that. I think that in terms of whether people get into the spectrum, far fewer people have autism and ADHD than don't. And I'm sure that lots of women at some point in their pregnancies take acetaminophen. Now, some don't. Some are like, I'm not taking any pharmaceutical anything during their pregnancy. I don't care how much pain or fever I have. And if you can get away with doing that, I think that's fine. It all depends on what's going on with you. If you get really sick, if you get COVID, if you get a febrile illness where you have a great big fever and the fever is, inching up over 100 and it's getting up to 102, 103, 104, and that's unusual for that to happen, but it can happen, then you should talk to your provider about whether you should take a medicine to calm that down. And if you can drink ginger tea, if you can make yourself sweat, if you can get in a bath, if you can do a hot foot bath with cold to your head, you might be able to bring the fever down without taking a medicine. So there are definitely natural ways to do that that are not that are very, you know, benign, especially using hydrotherapy, diaphoretics, things that make you sweat. Like ginger is a safe diaphoretic in pregnancy. So is sticking your feet in warm water and putting cold to your head. And always put cold to your head if you're doing a hot bath, because that way you don't get lightheaded. But making yourself sweat, you don't want to overheat yourself. You don't go in a hot tub when you're pregnant. You can go in a warm tub when you're pregnant, but you don't immerse yourself in very hot water when you're pregnant. But you can get in a tub that's warm. You can get in a warm shower, and you can do a hot foot bath where you put your feet in hot water, and then you definitely put cold to your head, and make yourself sweat a bit that way. You can eat spicy food if you want to. If you're very close to giving birth, if you eat too much spicy food, you might start having contractions, and you might not. I mean, there are women who have tried that and it helps, and there are women who have tried that and it's like, nope, gotta wait them a couple more days. But anyway, and things that can help you that way can help to bring fever down. You can also do homeopathy. There are great homeopathic remedies that are safe. Either they work or they don't, and they're not going to hurt the baby. So if you take homeopathic belladonna, for example, you have to look at the indications for each remedy. So belladonna, you have a really high fever, you're a little bit delirious, you don't quite know where you are, your face or your body might be very red. That's one that we use for fever. Homeopathic apis is another one. You might be itchy if you have apis, and you might be very irritable. Aconite is another one. Aconite, you'd be really like very anxious and freaked out, and you might actually have prickly sensations in your skin. Formication is a symptom of homeopathic aconite, and formication, the word comes from ants. That's the feeling that ants are biting you. And so homeopathic aconite is another one that you can use. So there's a bunch of things you could do short of taking acetaminophen if you have to. And if you have tried those things and they're not working and you're getting concerned, you can either take a little bit of acetaminophen, and you can also just call your provider. If you're not sure what to do, always call your provider and get some information. All right. So that's the acetaminophen situation. All right. So now I was going to just talk about why fish oil is good for you. And I have talked about this before, but it bears repeating, because fish oil is good for you. I'm a fan. It's a great source of omega-3 fatty acids. It's good for your heart and brain. However, this article thinks that getting it from fish is healthier. And I have told you before that getting it from smash fish is the best. And remember that the smash fish, smash is an acronym. It doesn't mean that the fish has to be smashed, although it's okay if it is. And some of these fish are harder to smash than others. It is easy to smash tuna fish and sardines. You can smash them easily because of their texture. But anyway, what smash stands for is salmon, mackerel, anchovies, sardines, and herring. And all of those, what smash fish have in common is that they are high in omega-3 fatty acids and low in mercury, because they're either they don't live in waters where they pick up the where they bioaccumulate mercury, or they're small. They're too small to have any significant bioaccumulation of mercury. So mackerel are not very big. Anchovies and sardines and herring are definitely quite small. Salmon just spend most of their life in fresh water, so they don't have a way to bioaccumulate mercury. They mate and spawn in fresh water, and then they spend some time in the ocean where they make more of their omega-3 fatty acids, and then they go back to fresh water to spawn. So they spend a lot of time in fresh water, so they don't tend to bioaccumulate mercury. So they're good that way. Great way to get omega-3 fatty acids. But fish oil itself is still good for you. So fish oil is generally extracted from smash fish, herring. It can be extracted from tuna, but not usually. The fish oil that I have for my patients is not. It's from generally mackerel, herring, and anchovies. Has omega-3 benefits, which have a lot of health benefits. 30% of fish oil is omega-3, and there is some vitamin A and D. If it's plain fish oil, there generally isn't much. If you get cod liver oil, there is going to be vitamins A and D. And the two big omega-3s are EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid, and DHA, which is docosahexaenoic acid. And plant sources is mostly ethyl linoleic acid. So the omega-3 that you're going to find in your flax seeds, your chia seeds, your nuts and seeds, your peanuts, those are all going to be ethyl linoleic acid, which can be converted to EPA and DHA in the body by enzymes. And the enzymes are generally delta 60 saturase, and not everybody has a good functioning delta 60 saturase system. And if you don't have a good delta 60 desaturase system, you're not going to do a very good job of converting your ethyl linoleic acid to EPA and DHA, and the yield is much lower than if you take fish oil or eat fish. But some people refuse to eat fish. Either they are vegetarians, or they're very averse to fish. I have a lot of patients who are averse to fish, that they won't eat fish, but they will take fish oil. And then some patients won't even take fish oil, because no matter what they do, they can taste the fish. So fish oil may support heart health. It helps to lower cholesterol and triglycerides, reduce your blood pressure, and prevent the formation of plaques that can harden arteries. There's evidence that says it can help reduce the severity of mortality from heart disease. So if you have cardiovascular disease, fish oil can be a good thing to have in your toolkit to help to treat it. It can help to treat certain mental health conditions. If you measure the weight of the brain without any fluid, it is about 20% polyunsaturated fatty acids, and that includes omega-3. So omega-3s are essential for brain function. Research suggests that people with certain mental health conditions have lower omega-3 blood levels, and having more omega-3s can help prevent the onset or improve symptoms of some mental health conditions like depression. Eye health. So omega-3s, if you get an eye supplement, a lot of eye supplements have omega-3s in them. If you don't get enough omega-3s, you have more risk of eye diseases, except for dry eye. A dry eye can happen despite your omega-3 consumption. Eye health begins to decline in old age. When they say old age, I wonder what age that is. I mean, I have to wear these glasses now. I can't read without them. So as you get older, you're more likely to get age-related macular degeneration. And if you eat fish, it's linked to a reduced risk of acute macular degeneration. Or age-related macular degeneration. But the results from supplements are less convincing than eating actual fish. Omega-3s, fish oil, may reduce inflammation. And it can help treat chronic and inflammatory conditions, like when you have increased weight, when you have stress, you tend to have more inflammation. And then in terms of inflammatory bowel disease, they're not quite clear about that. But fish oil can help reduce joint pain, stiffness, and medication needs with people. It's been specifically studied for rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune condition that causes joint pain. Fish oil can help make your skin nice. Yeah, I have nice skin. I'm 61 years old and I'm all right. I guess it's okay. If you can see me on YouTube or on Facebook, you can see my skin's all right. I have decent genes as well. Anyway, I take fish oil every day. So the skin is the largest organ in your body. It has a lot of omega-3 fatty acids. It can be beneficial for psoriasis and any kind of dermatitis, which means any kind of inflammation in your skin. It's one of the things I recommend first to people with any kind of skin inflammation, whether it's eczema, psoriasis, seborrheic dermatitis, any kind of long-standing skin irritation. And if you're pregnant, fish oil is a good thing to have on board. It's great for early growth, particularly during the first trimester of pregnancy and beyond. If you take supplements while pregnant or nursing, it can help improve the child's cognitive development. And fish oil during pregnancy and nursing may also improve infant visual development and help reduce their risk of getting allergies. Fish oil may help to reduce liver fat. So if you've been told you have fatty liver, if you have elevated liver enzymes, they check to see if there's any disease process causing it. And they're like, nope, you just have fatty liver. Then if you take fish oil, it can help to reduce the fat in your liver. It helps to reduce liver function and inflammation. It can reduce symptoms of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and overall the amount of fat in your liver. It's possible that fish oil can help improve attention and hyperactivity in children. So ADHD can be helped by fish oil, may improve perceived hyperactivity in attention, impulsiveness, and aggression. which can help with early learning. And then fish oil can also help with symptoms of mental decline. People who eat more fish tend to have a slower decline in brain function in old age. And there was a study in 2023, a meta-analysis, where omega-3 supplements were shown to help reduce dementia and old age-related cognitive decline by as much as 20%. So I'm going to keep taking my fish oil so I can stay smart. Fish oil may help improve asthma symptoms and allergy risk. So asthma causes swelling in your lungs and shortness of breath. It's becoming more common, and studies show that omega-3 may help with reducing asthma-related inflammation, the severity of symptoms, and even your need to use asthma medications. That needs to be confirmed. And bone health. Calcium and vitamin D are important for bone health, especially in older age, but there are studies that suggest that omega-3 can also be beneficial. People with higher omega-3 intakes and blood levels may have better bone mineral density. So it's a very basic supplement. I give fish oil to almost everybody. I recommend that almost everybody take it because it's so basic. It helps with so many things. It reduces inflammation, helps your mood. And there's all these conditions all over your body that it can be helpful with. It's not entirely clear whether fish oil supplements improve the bone mineral density. It may depend on the type of fish oil and the supplements. So it's not saying here how it does that. So I'm going to surmise that the fish oil, if you're taking fish oil, we know that fish oil, the essential fatty acids are part of every cell membrane in your body, and they improve membrane fluidity. So if you have fluid cell membranes, so nutrition can pass in and out of the cells more readily. So if you have healthy osteocytes, bone cells, then if you have essential fatty acids that are in good health in your osteocytes, the cells of your bones, nutrition is going to be able to pass in and out of those cells more easily than if you do not. So if you need more calcium, magnesium, copper, zinc, manganese, collagen, protein to help to build up your bones, if you have healthy cell membranes, you're going to be more likely to have that going on. So that's one way that it can help. We know that part of why people get osteopenia and osteoporosis is inflammation. Why? Because, what did I say? When you have too much cortisol runs around your body, looks for stuff to break down, so it can turn it into sugar so you can run away from the bear. That includes your bones. If you have too much stress and too much cortisol around, your body's going to use the proteins in your bones to turn it into sugar. And so if you have essential fatty acids on board, you're going to have more hormones available so that your cortisol is not going to go after the bones as much, and you're not going to have as much inflammation, and the inflammation is not going to break down your bones either. When you have more inflammation, you have more cortisol around, you have more inflammation, and you're going to have more breakdown of tissue. And when you have more essential fatty acids on board, you're going to have less inflammation, and you're going to have a better moderated cortisol, so you're going to have less bony breakdown. So I'm assuming that's how it works. So dosing recommends that you eat around 8 ounces of seafood a week if you're eating 2,000 calories, which is not a huge amount. Ron and I think we eat more of that. Pregnant and nursing, you want to do more like 12 ounces. So you might want to eat a quarter a pound three times a week, 2 to 3 times a week. So that's where that two to three times a week comes from. Your 4 ounces at a sitting is reasonable. Fish oil supplements come in a lot of forms. It comes in ethyl esters, triglycerides, reformed triglycerides, free fatty acids, phospholipids. And your body doesn't absorb ethyl esters as well as other forms. When you get prescription fish oil, you might be saving money because it's a prescription and it's covered by your insurance, but it's not as well absorbed as the forms that you get in a supplement, like the triglyceride form. And so the form that I'm taking, the oil that I take a liquid fish oil, not in pills. It's the triglyceride form. So I'm not taking the ethyl esters. And so ethyl esters don't work as well as supplements that you get. And then you want to try to get in at least 500 milligrams of EPA and DHA per 1,000 milligrams of fish oil. So depending, it all depends on the person. It depends how big they are, what their metabolism is like, their age. And I will give people directions about how much fish oil they should take. You want to make sure that it's pure, that it really has EPA and DHA in it, and that it's been, really, I prefer that it says how much EPA and DHA that it has in it, and also that it's been tested to make sure there's no mold, there's no mercury. People are like, oh, I don't want to take fish oil because there's mercury in it. Well, generally, again, fish oil is generally made from fish that don't have mercury. You don't generally take tuna oil. The fish oil is made from smash fish. There's generally, and then a really good company is going to make sure it's tested. So there's absolutely no need to worry about mercury or other heavy metals. So just make sure you get a brand that has no heavy metals in it. And you want to make sure it's fresh. So fish oil can go rancid because any oil that has polyunsaturated fats in it, which is what omega-3 fatty acid, they are a polyunsaturated fat. Unsaturated means that two carbons are hooked together and they have a number of the carbons that are hooked together have at least a double bond. And generally, in an omega-3 fish oil, it's going to have a double bond. Omega-3 means that the first double bond occurs at the third carbon in. And then there are more double bonds along the chain of carbons. And that's a polyunsaturated fat. Unsaturated means that there's going to be at least one double bond. A saturated fat has no double bonds. All the carbons are bonded singly to the other carbons with other things poking out like oxygen, hydroxyl groups, and hydrogen. So the thing is, the more double bonds you have, the more subject to oxidation and free radical damage the fatty acid is. And the word rancid literally means a breakdown of double bonds in a fat. And so when you smell like people who have, they get massage and then the oil gets onto the sheets and then the sheets go in the wash and then they go in the dryer, and after a while the sheets can have that burn smell, and that burn smell is rancid oil. It's really not good for you. And so that's why you're not supposed to overheat oil when you're frying, and you're not supposed to eat a lot of deep fried food because you're heating up the oil and you're creating free radicals and you're creating trans fats and you're creating lipid peroxidation. So fish oil is subject to that. And if you open a bottle of fish oil and it smells too fishy, it's gone through some oxidation. So the best way to prevent that is to keep your fish oil in the fridge. And that's what I do. I keep my liquid fish oil in the refrigerator. If you have a very cold house, you might be able to get away with keeping it on the counter, but I wouldn't recommend it. Much better to be in the freezer. Right now we're having, it's going to be, next week it's going to be 80 degrees and 60 degrees and 70 degrees and 80, and we don't even know because it's October in Connecticut. And so who knows what it's going to be. The fish oil goes in the fridge. So I keep other oils in the fridge as well. My evening primrose oil is in the fridge. My MCT oil is in the fridge. And my black cumin seed oil is in the fridge. Everything's in the fridge. So that's what you want to do. You can certainly take it every day. And you should only not take it if you have a fish allergy. You should really consult your doctor. You also have to talk to your doctor if you're taking blood thinning medications. And so if you're on things like clopidogrel or warfarin or Coumadin, warfarin, Coumadin are the same thing. One is the brand name and one is the generic name. If you're on Xarelto, also known as rivaroxaban, or if you're on apixaban, which is known as, that the brand name is Eliquis. Usually you can take fish oil if you're also taking apixaban or rivaroxaban. You have to be careful if you're taking clopidogrel or if you're taking warfarin. So talk to your doctor about that. There was a study that showed that DHA-enriched fish oil increased testosterone levels in overweight and obese men, which you might want or you might not, depending on what your testosterone levels are. So omega-3s contribute to brain and eye development. They fight inflammation, can help prevent heart disease because there's a lot of omega-3s. People who are at risk of health conditions can benefit from taking it. But it's a really good idea to also eat fish. And eating fish 2 to 3 times a week, especially smash fish, is going to be really helpful for you as well. And fish is as effective as fish oil is preventing many diseases, if not more so. I don't always eat smash fish. Like I have a problem eating some salmon. We're still trying to figure out if I'm okay with salmon or not, because I had a few episodes where Ron made salmon and I didn't feel well after I ate the salmon. And I feel fine after I eat things like haddock and cod and flounder and trout and even tuna. And we do tuna once in a while. We get, you know, small tuna steaks and we don't eat them. We don't eat it every week. Tuna is very high in omega-3 fatty acids. It's just that you're more concerned about the bioaccumulation of heavy metals. And so I don't always eat smash fish. I do have herring around, but I don't have it every day. I have anchovies around. I don't have them every day. Apparently I can eat packaged smoked salmon and that seems to be okay. But again, I don't have that every day, but I take fish oil every day because I don't necessarily eat, the highest omega-3 fish all the time, even though we do eat fish probably 3 or 4 times a week. This week we had haddock. And Ron had salmon. I did not have salmon. Oh, well, I did. I had lox because it was after Yom Kippur and I had a bagel and lox, which is smoked salmon. So anyway, so I take fish oil to support myself because I don't necessarily eat, just because of the way our life runs, I don't always get the smash fish on board. So that way I'm sure I'm getting the omega-3 fatty acids. I'm getting my anti-inflammatory benefits. So that's the deal with fish oil. We're going to go into why MUFAs, monounsaturated fats, are good for you. We don't have much time left, so I'm probably going to leave it here, but I will just, teaser. We're going to talk about the benefits of monounsaturated fats. Monounsaturated fats, remember I said that saturated fats have no double bonds in them. Polyunsaturated fats have more than one double bond in them. Monounsaturated fats have just one double bond in them. And generally, when you eat nuts and seeds and olives and olive oil and stuff like that, they have oleic acid in them. And oleic acid is from olives, but it's in nuts and seeds as well. It's in avocados. And oleic acid is an omega-9 fatty acid. What that means is there is one double bond and it is at the 9th carbon. And that's what an omega-9 means. Omega-6 means the first double bond is at the 6th carbon, and omega-3 means the first double bond is at the 3rd carbon. So that's your teaser. We'll talk about monounsaturated fats next week, and I'm going to let you go. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Doors and WHUS.org.